school is out in more than 150 countries today as students take to the streets and demand action on climate change.
We want change!
We want change!
We want change!
We want it now!
We want change!
Activists in Hong Kong have grown bold. A leader of the leaderless movement there says a quarter of the population in Hong Kong has taken to the streets. Just imagine that in the U.S.
Will the U.S. administration keep silence? And now that's what happened in Hong Kong.
And recreating outer space in a cave in Slovenia.
If you're an astronaut, you don't often get told to go out and search for new life forms, but you can do that in a cave.
Can you do that? I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Classrooms are empty across the world today. Millions of children are playing hooky and trying to push their leaders to act on climate change. Today's Global Day of Action kicked off in the streets of Australia and Asia. The movement followed the path of the sun, spreading to Africa, Europe, and finally North and South America. Here's a mother and daughter at the protests in Nairobi, Kenya.
I want the government to listen to us and stop this coal mining and also take care of the environment and also restore our forests.
My message is I want all the children to plant trees.
Today's protests were inspired by 16-year-old Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. She's been skipping school on Fridays for more than a year, demonstrating to try and get Swedish leaders to act. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler is covering the strike in New York. Activists there are marching ahead of a key UN climate summit that kicks off in New York next week. Carolyn, what are you seeing out there?
Carol, there is just a mass of humanity passing by me here on Center Street in Lower Manhattan, walking toward Battery Park. I've been standing near this spot for more than an hour. There are a bunch of young people, some of their parents, holding protest signs, walking down the street. You might hear some drums in the background. The strike started here in New York in December, and I spoke to an activist, Shia Bastida, a high schooler who's been striking here since about March.
Striking is a very, very powerful tool for us because we are saying, how are you asking us to go to school for a future that we might not be able to have? Striking is a last resort, and we are using it because we are in an emergency. And it's amazing to see that in Germany alone, 1.4 million people marched today. And that sense of empowerment is amazing.
Carolyn, the topic is a serious one. So is the mood kind of serious or more festive?
It's pretty exuberant is the word I would use. People here, you know, what they're calling for is serious. They're calling for a complete pivot away from fossil fuels and what people call a just transition. So sort of an equitable transition for folks who rely on fossil fuels to make their living and also help for folks in frontline communities who are the most affected by climate change. But it's a bunch of kids skipping school. So, you know, there's a lot of happiness here. There's a lot of, like I said, chanting and drums in the streets. Here are some New York City school kids reading their protest signs for me.
Burning fossils becoming fossils.
Stop climate change.
Make a better place.
There is no planet B.
We want change.
We want change.
We want it now.
We want change.
We want it now.
Science, not silence.
Climate strikes have become sort of an annual event. I mean, they've been happening every fall for at least a couple of years. Does this one feel different?
There's definitely a different energy here. This one has been infused by youth, and these youth climate strikes have made this a much higher profile topic. Shia Bastida, who we just heard from, spoke in front of Congress this week, and she hopes that there's more sort of moral weight to this message right now because it's coming from these sort of future generations.
I know that it's different now because we have moral authority, because now we don't have 100 years or 50 years. Now we're living it, and we are scared, and we are angry, and we want our politicians to listen to the science and listen to our message.
She sounds pretty passionate. It sounds like that kind of countdown feeling has really given this urgency.
Yeah, there is definitely the feeling of this countdown here. So I also heard from Rebecca Shabnan, who's speaking at the event on stage, and says, you know, she's striking because this is her option.
We can't vote, but by the time that we do, it's too late. So we're striking so that future generations don't have to, so that we can have the future that we need.
They're pretty impressive.
It is, Carol, and you're not the only one to think so, which they're hoping works to forward their message to people in power.
The World's Carolyn Beeler on the streets of Manhattan. We'll hear more from her later in the show. Thanks a lot, Carolyn.
You're welcome, Carol.
President Trump has a lot on his plate today. Climate protests, a potentially explosive new scandal in the White House, and the biggest question a president can face: war. Trump met today with his National Security Council to discuss military options against Iran, a possible response to a massive attack on Saudi Arabia's oil facilities last weekend. Speaking today, Trump said striking Iran was the easy option, but added,
I think the strong person's approach and the thing that does show strength would be showing a little bit of restraint.
Saudi Arabia says Iran was unquestionably responsible for the attack, even though it's not yet clear from where the attack was launched. Iran denies any responsibility. Michelle Flournoy was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Barack Obama. She's now managing partner of the strategic advisory firm West Exec Advisors. What could the U.S. do against Iran militarily? What's the minimum option?
Well, I think there are a number of options at the lower end of the spectrum, and my understanding is that is what the Pentagon is focused on at the moment. They could be clandestine, such as using cyber operations to impact various Iranian facilities. They could be limited kinetic attacks on Iranian assets that are not on Iranian soil.
What's a kinetic attack?
A kinetic attack is using a missile or a drone or an aircraft to conduct some kind of strike with a physical impact. And I think that, again, they'd be looking to minimize any casualties and ensure that you're not setting the stage for dramatic escalation. Because the other big question on the table is, you know, we're not doing this in a vacuum. Iran gets a vote. So how will Iran likely respond? And here, I think you see a lot of concern on the part of Saudi Arabia to be very measured in first attributing the attack, making sure we have our facts straight, and second, thinking through not just what the U.S. response would be, but how would then the Iranians respond to that? Because I think they probably fear that they could be the target of additional Iranian attacks. We also have to remember we have U.S. personnel on the ground in Iraq, which is right next door. Iran has a number of proxy groups operating in Iraq, and you could imagine a situation where they decide in retaliation to target U.S. personnel.
Let's ratchet it up one notch. What would be next after the minimum option?
Well, I think you could imagine striking targets in Iran, such as their missile launch sites or drone launch sites, their storage facilities, the bases where they operate. And so you could walk up the ladder that way. But I think once you get into anything but the most limited strikes on Iranian territory, you're starting to walk up the escalation ladder.
How much of this military talk is really part of diplomacy?
Well, certainly discussion of military options or any coercive measures, including, you know, the threat for additional economic sanctions, you know, can be used as leverage in trying to make your diplomacy more effective and in bringing a reluctant party to the table. But you also have to take care that when you do appear to make military threats, that you don't repeatedly not follow through on them, because then over time you damage your own credibility. And there is some indications from what I've seen that the Iranian leadership has started to question President Trump's seriousness and sort of seeing him a little bit as a paper tiger. So it's a very delicate dance, but no one should be putting threats on the table that they don't intend to carry out, particularly the United States of America.
Michelle Flournoy was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Barack Obama. She's now managing partner of the strategic advisory firm West Exec Advisors. Thanks a lot, Michelle.
Thank you.
The photos of Canada's leader, Justin Trudeau, dressed in blackface in his younger years were shocking. It got people up north talking a lot about identity and discrimination. Our next story focuses on both. In the province of Quebec, school is back in session for the first time since the passage of a new law banning teachers from wearing religious symbols, items like headscarves. Emma Jacobs reports on the questions it's raised for teachers.
It's not a complete ban to start with. The bill included a grandfather clause for teachers already on the job. So Maha Kassif returned to the classroom wearing her headscarf. She's working 3 days a week at a French language elementary school in the Montreal region.
It's always like the first 2 weeks, you just feel like you've been run over by a truck.
I have like my
But Kasif, on her couch watching her three-year-old play at the end of a long day, says she also feels extra stressed this year over the new law.
That's the gray area that I don't know where I am.
The rules are so new, she has questions she can't answer. Like whether she's definitely protected by the grandfather clause as a substitute teacher moving between schools. Also, the law bars her from future promotions if she won't remove her headscarf. So,
am I forever going to be a substitute teacher, going from one part-time contract to the next?
Her mother was a principal at a private school. Kasif, who has taught in Quebec and Ontario since 2006, wanted to eventually get trained as a principal, too.
For me, it kind of dashes a lot of the things that I had prepared for myself.
The legislation passed by a wide margin in the provincial legislature. Its focus on visible religious dress comes from a combination of historical and political influences. That's according to Solange Lefebvre, a professor at the Institute for Religious Studies at the University of Montreal.
You find a certain allergy to religious visibility.
French-speaking Quebec and France, which has similar legislation, both have an anti-clerical streak that emerged in response to past domination by the Catholic Church. They were among many places where distrust of immigrants and Islam rose since the 2000s.
But in Quebec and France and some other countries, it takes the form of especially this Muslim women wearing a hijab or a niqab or a burqa.
Lefebvre opposes the bill because she thinks it stigmatizes religious minorities. But she notes its supporters do include some recent immigrants from Muslim-majority countries in North Africa. Nadia El Mabrouk came to Canada from Tunisia, has two children in the public schools, and testified in support of the religious symbols bill.
Alors, il faut leur assurer un enseignement qui soit exempt de prosélytisme religieux.
We need to assure children an education without religious proselytizing. And religious symbols aren't neutral. They transmit messages that are not neutral.
She also recently signed a letter supporting a parent's right to have their child moved out of a class if a teacher is still wearing a hijab.
The
law stipulates clearly that every citizen has a right to public services that are secular.
After press coverage of the case of a parent who wanted their child pulled from class, Quebec's government made it clear that wouldn't be allowed. But Nuzhat Jaffrey, executive director of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women, says the whole conversation around the bill has encouraged intolerance on the ground in Quebec.
So we're hearing about incidents, you know, occurring more often than they used to before the law passed, of young Muslim women having their headscarves pulled off, people calling them names.
Local media have reported on several cases of newly hired teachers who have been refused jobs or asked not to wear their religious dress.
This is a recipe for disengagement and disenchantment with Quebec. So many people will leave, and as have been leaving, to go find employment elsewhere.
The returning teacher, Maha Kasif, says she's felt self-conscious in ways she hadn't before about how other teachers and parents perceive her headscarf. She argues it shouldn't matter.
My presence in the classroom wearing something on my head is just basically like representing the multiculturalism that they're going to encounter outside of the school. So I don't see the problem with that. Like, we're just a reflection of their daily life.
The religious symbols bill is being challenged in court by a university student who was training to become a teacher when the law was passed. Simone Jolin-Barrette, Quebec's Minister of Immigration, Francicization, and Integration, did not respond to our interview request, but spoke with Radio Canada this summer.
Monsieur le ministre, bonjour.
Bonjour, Monsieur Nouvel.
When the legal challenge began, Jolin-Barrette said that Quebec's government is confident in the soundness of its legislation, which he called moderate and balanced. For The World, I'm Emma Jacobs in Montreal.
You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. The media has been calling it Hong Kong's summer of discontent. Discontent feels like an understatement. We've seen mass protests, violence, and arrests all over the news. Problems started back in April when Hong Kong introduced legislation that would allow criminal suspects in Hong Kong to be extradited for trial in China. In June, more than a million Hong Kongers came out in the streets, protesting, chanting, and even singing Broadway show tunes.
Singing the song.
Do You Hear the People Sing from Les Miserables became an unofficial protest anthem earlier this summer. But in the months since then, the protests have changed and become far more aggressive. Earlier this month, Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, withdrew the extradition bill, which started all of this in the first place.
I announced that the bill was suspended and later reiterated that the bill is dead and that all the legislative work had come to a complete halt.
But for many protesters, that was too little, too late. Since Lam's announcement, the protests have continued and become violent.
Seeds of violence have spread across the city as street battles have evolved into violent fighting.
Officially, Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement is leaderless, but several young activists have become key faces of the uprising. Chief among them is Joshua Wong. Wong is 22 years old, and he's been arrested and jailed repeatedly in the past few years for his activism. I asked Wong what he thinks about some pro-democracy protesters resorting to violence.
Force has been used by protesters, but we're strongly aware that there's more intention to have self-protect and self-defense when life-threatening force were used by riot police. And instead of blaming on activists, I think it's more important to focus on what's the demand of protesters and what's the demands of Hong Kongers. We're just asking for free election. That's the promise made by Beijing to Hong Kong before the transfer of sovereignty. And now it's Beijing who broke the promise.
But not all the violence by activists is responding to police. Some of it is initiated. And do you risk splintering support for the movement by activists instigating violence themselves?
None of the protesters will indiscriminately use force and randomly use force to target any ordinary citizen. That's what just done and did by Hong Kong police. We just have to let the world to know that how Hong Kong people are just determined and have the courage to ask for freedom and democracy.
So you're saying that activists who are throwing bricks or throwing petrol bombs at police lines, that that's okay because they're not throwing them at civilians?
I think it's better don't put your word in my mouth. And what I explain is even we can't expect that everyone around the world will agree on all the behaviors of protesters. But I think instead of just criticizing or blaming on the tactics of some of the individual protesters, it's more important to focus on the fundamental cause of Hong Kong people.
But are you worried that increasingly radical tactics will splinter your movement? You've got a wide breadth of Hong Kongers who are supporting you. Do you think that the use of violence by activists could dissuade people from hanging in with the movement?
I didn't agree it's the use of violence. It's the use of force react on the life-threatening violence from the riot police. Especially, I hope to emphasize that when one-fourth of population in Hong Kong took to the street peacefully, asked for free election, just imagine if in US more than one-fourth of citizens took to the street with the demand on specific political system reform. Will the US administration keep silence? And now that's what happened in Hong Kong.
I'm curious how much you're willing to risk personally.
Actions speak louder than words. I've been arrested for 8 times, been jailed for 3 times, and now we strongly experience the crackdown of human rights. And I've spent more than 120 days in prison. But compared to other activists that already being locked up in prison for 6 years, the price I pay is really small.
How will you know when you've achieved what you want? What's the end point for you?
Freedom and democracy. Guarantee Hong Kong people enjoy autonomy. I hope Hong Kong can be the place that we can free from fear from Beijing.
But that's rather abstract and subjective. What are the specific things you want to see?
We hope to have election system reform. The leader of Hong Kong would not be handpicked by Beijing. It could be elected by Hong Kong people.
You and other key people in this protest movement seem to not want to be referred to as the leaders, but many Hong Kongers see you as the leaders. Are you willing to kind of take up that mantle?
What's meant by any Hong Kongers see me as leader? Is any kind of scientific reference or any assumption? Yeah.
Well, Google.
I think it's hard for a formal radio program to say that, oh, just Google it, because I think when Hong Kong people already get consensus of this a leaderless movement, I don't recognize myself as leader. I just recognize myself as facilitators. And I think if you just suddenly say that, oh, Hong Kong people still recognize you as the leader of the movement, I think it seems to be far away from my general understanding as I'm the one live in Hong Kong and join protests every day or every week.
Well, we're talking to you on the radio. You're in Washington. You're making the rounds, you and several other people. Whether you like it or not, many people or the international press, the international community, and I think a number of protesters see you and a number of other individuals as the spokespeople and the leaders of this. Why are you reluctant to take on the mantle of a leader of this movement?
We don't have bought off decision maker from the protester side. At the same time, we also don't have a single individual politician or leader that can represent 2 million people. Instead of assuming it's any kind of reluctant, I think it's just expressing, instead of having top-down command from politician to ordinary protester.
But after you finish speaking with me, you're heading to the State Department. So you're speaking to representatives of the U.S. about your situation. What are you going to be talking to them about?
We urge U.S. government stop exporting riot weapons to Hong Kong police. At the same time, it's also a must to pass the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act in the U.S. Congress. Instead of overriding human rights by trade or business interests, it's more important for U.S. to reveal its foreign policy to China and Hong Kong.
What do you want them to do specifically?
Pass the bill in the Congress, Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. And that's the bill that will start and launch the legislation process in the next few weeks.
And how much support do you have for that bill?
When Speaker Pelosi held the press conference, announced that she will facilitate the House to pass the bill as soon as possible, and how the chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, both from the House and Senate, met with us and to show their support to stand with Hong Kong, I hope this bill can pass within this year.
Is your being in the U.S., along with a number of other key people from the protest movement, do you feel that that's sending a strong signal to Beijing?
It shows how the world will not ignore Hong Kong. It also shows that Hong Kong people never walk alone. When Hong Kong people were fired by rubber bullets and tear gas that are made in Pennsylvania in U.S., now we are calling U.S. government stop to export riot weapons. Especially U.S. should not be the helping hands of Hong Kong's crackdown on human rights.
Joshua Wong is a key person in the Hong Kong protests. He's been arrested and jailed repeatedly since his initial role in the 2014 Umbrella Movement. I want to thank you for speaking with us, Joshua.
Thank you.
You're with the world. The U.S. is sending $250 million in military aid to Ukraine. But what's the money for? And could support for Ukraine become part of a wider Washington scandal? Also, here's something you don't hear every day.
I am very fond of mosquitoes. I know that sounds weird, but I am.
Scientists build a kinder mosquito. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. There's an explosive question gripping Washington today, and it's shrouded in mystery. Did President Trump make an inappropriate promise to a foreign leader? Clearly, Trump doesn't think so.
Ridiculous story. It's a partisan whistleblower. I shouldn't even have information. I've had conversations with many leaders that are always appropriate.
But was the conversation appropriate? Here's what we know. A whistleblower in the intelligence community made a complaint about an urgent concern. President Trump's Director of National Intelligence is blocking Congress from learning about it. It seems to be about Ukraine. The Washington Post first reported this. House Democrats are now examining whether President Trump and his attorney, Rudy Giuliani, tried to manipulate the Ukrainian government into helping Trump's reelection by looking into dealings there by Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden's son. Here's what else we know. Congress approved $250 million in military aid to Ukraine. In late August, congressional Democrats and Republicans criticized the White House for delaying delivery of that funding. It's a murky story with plenty of unnamed sources and strong accusations. But we had this question. What is $250 million in aid to Ukraine for? We called up Nina Jankowicz with the Wilson Center in Washington.
Ukraine is fighting a hot war against Russia. Many people forget that there is a war on the European continent right now, and Ukraine needs all the support that it can get. So this is just helping Ukraine modernize its military and continue to keep Russia at bay. often, you know, this is a diplomatic strategy that many in the State Department and in the White House will use in terms of pushing reform forward. And here, there was no ostensible reason why that aid would be withheld.
Now, it's interesting because Ukraine is a country that's trying to adopt Western values and be an ally with the U.S. Did they feel like this was a slap in the face to withhold this aid?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's a slap in the face to Ukraine because they've been walking this long and difficult path of democratic reform for the past 5 years. This is not the type of value that we usually put before the democratic development of another country. Here, what we're doing is trying to secure the political future of one man and putting that above the democratic development and national security and sovereignty of another nation. And that just doesn't square with American values in my mind. Not to mention that for the many doubters of democracy around the globe, we've just now in a very public way said that this is how the United States does democracy these days and this sort of quid pro quo. And that's something that would have been unimaginable a couple of years ago.
And $250 million isn't a whole lot of money when it comes to what Ukrainian troops really need, right?
That is a very good point and something that I'm sure many in Kyiv would agree with, especially considering that this war has been going on for over 5 years now and the great leaps and bounds in reform that the Ukrainian military has made in that time. It's a small amount of money, especially when you consider what our own Department of Defense military budget is every year. And I think it's a small token of support for a country that has been a beacon of democracy for many around the world over the past 5 years.
The U.S. has now released the aid to Ukraine. Why did they do so?
Well, we don't know exactly why. I see one of three reasons. It could be that the Zelensky administration is now kowtowing to Trump's demands, although we have no indication of that. The administration has not released any comment since this story broke over the past 24 hours. The second possibility is that because Congressman Adam Schiff requested that that whistleblower complaint be unsealed, it's possible the Trump administration decided at that point that the jig was up and the public would be finding out about the threat that they made to the Ukrainian government in that regard, withholding the aid in exchange for the investigation. And the third possibility is just that there was a large amount of public outcry, not only in the Ukrainian community, Ukraine Watcher community, but on the Hill, there is bipartisan support for military aid to Ukraine. And there was a lot of shock on Capitol Hill over the past couple of weeks as this was being withheld. So I think it could be any combination of the above, but certainly the public outcry was significant. And it's heartening to me to know that there is still that bipartisan support for Ukraine.
Nina Jankowicz is a Wilson and Kennan Institute Fellow in Washington. Thanks, Nina.
Thank you, Carol.
Forest fires continue in the Amazon. Since January, there have been 4,515 fires. That's the latest tally from Brazil's space agency. But this story is not about that. It's about a single tree, a very tall one, that scientists say may be the tallest ever measured in the Amazon.
It's in a national park in the Pará state, in a very remote area. So this group of people, they had to travel by boat around 240 kilometers.
That's 150 miles into the rainforest.
It took them 6 days to arrive there.
The BBC's Fernanda Odila has been speaking with the research team that made the trip. She says the team began by flying drones above the forest canopy in search of unusually tall trees.
The rainforest is super dense. So sometimes it's very difficult to spot something super high because they are all together in a cluster.
Odila says they found clusters in several parts of the forest rising far above the canopy.
And they've picked this specific cluster to go there and to confirm their findings with their own eyes.
Here's what they saw.
15 giant trees, and one of them, it was the tallest tree ever recorded in the rainforest, 88 meters tall.
88 meters. That's about 288 feet, nearly as tall as the Statue of Liberty, including the torch. Odila says the team of scientists that found the tree came from all over, Brazil, the UK, and Finland, plus a lot of locals to help them get there, including carrying their boats through the forest and climbing and cutting their way through the undergrowth.
And they had one guy who is a specialist in climbing trees, because they had to measure one by one to see where it was the highest one, the tallest one.
This red-brown tree was a red angelin. Looks kind of like a California redwood.
It's very common in the area, but not that high. And it's a strong, strong tree used for timber.
Odila has a personal connection to the rainforest. She grew up there and remembers visiting the northern edge of Brazil's Amazon region when she was a child and seeing the forest stretch to the horizon.
So it caught my attention at that time because I saw logs of woods going down the river, massive logs. And we didn't know if they were legally or illegally cut. But at that time, it wasn't a concern, I must say.
Odila says Brazilians know the Amazon is important for the whole planet, but still, they just aren't that worried about its destruction. She says the researchers assured her that this red angelin is safe, far away from the fires, and that it's protected from illegal logging. The team continues to study the tree to learn how it's managed to grow and survive.
They say it's very unique and unusual because it not only shows that we know very little about the rainforest, it shows that there are treasures or wonders still hidden from the public. And that's why they highlight this discovery as very important.
That's the BBC's Fernanda Odila. Mosquitoes are a serious threat around the globe. They carry deadly diseases like malaria and dengue. One way scientists are trying to fight the problem is with more mosquitoes, specifically mosquitoes that are genetically engineered to wipe out the wild, disease-carrying kind. A groundbreaking experiment took place in Brazil a few years ago, but a new study is raising questions about the impacts of releasing laboratory mosquitoes into the wild. The World's Alana Gordon reports.
The mosquito has always fascinated Jeff Powell.
I am very fond of mosquitoes. I know that sounds weird, but I am. Actually, if you look at them under a microscope, they're quite attractive and quite elegant creatures.
Powell is a geneticist and evolutionary biologist at Yale University. Despite his love, he realizes they're up to no good.
As far as I know, mosquitoes do nothing positive for us.
They're a threat to humanity. Cases of mosquito-borne diseases like dengue have exploded. A few years ago, Powell was in Brazil studying mosquitoes and their genetic ability to transmit diseases. And while he was there, he heard about this big experiment that was about to take place. A group of British and Brazilian scientists there were readying to release 500,000 mosquitoes that had been genetically engineered to have a so-called fatal gene.
And that means that the mosquitoes carrying these, anything that mates with them, all the offspring die.
So keep up the mating and wipe out that next generation of deadly mosquitoes. Powell immediately had questions. He wanted to know, would these transgenic mosquitoes released in the wild mess with the genetic makeup of the natural population?
So I quickly went up there and I talked to them.
He got the support he needed and set up a genetic monitoring study. He sampled the wild population before the release started as a baseline. Then the release began. It was done by a British-based company, Oxitec, with the backing of the Brazilian government. Picture a truck driving down the streets of a small city in northern Brazil, releasing a puff of mosquitoes every 100 yards or so. Genetically altered insects can be a tough sell. A few years ago, residents of a Florida Keys town rejected a similar project. It took a lot of community outreach to bring people around to the whole idea in Brazil.
To do this was face-to-face job.
Margaret Capurro was one of the scientists involved. She's a biochemist at the University of Sao Paulo.
So the people from the project went to the houses and talked to the people. So we talked with the whole city for many different things.
Capurro calls herself a mosquito architect because she spent her career designing mosquitoes. She really wants to make a difference.
I am a very optimistic.
And so after the two-year experiment, she was pleased with how things turned out. Just as researchers had hoped, the population of disease-carrying mosquitoes dropped.
The mosquitoes were so low for so long for a period.
Everything seemed great. Oxitec was expanding, looking to replicate the results elsewhere, including here in the U.S. But this month, the results of Jeff Powell's study on the genetic impact of this Brazilian experiment on the wider mosquito population were published. It found that some of the genetic material from those engineered mosquitoes had carried into the wild population. News of the study appears to be prompting a backlash in Brazil.
I think now the community is completely like, what?
Capurro has been getting news headlines in her inbox that include things like irresponsibility produces dengue super mosquito.
Everything was so good, and now they are saying that it's very, very bad.
Capurro herself is not worried about the results of the monitoring study. Neither is the company Oxitec. They were expecting some genetic mixing, and they didn't find any negative impact. But Capurro was unprepared for the public reaction and is mad at herself for not anticipating it.
I work with transgenic mosquitoes basically my whole life. And I try to demystify transgenics. And I blame myself because today I did the wrong thing.
And this is the irony. Capurro is one of the co-authors on Powell's genetic monitoring study.
I put monsters in the head of the people.
She worries the language in the study came off as alarmist. That's what the company thinks, and they're calling for changes to the study. Powell doesn't want to hurt the work on transgenic mosquitoes, especially as bugs build resistance to insecticide. But as a matter of principle, he says, researchers should always bear in mind unanticipated effects, including the hypothetical that an even stronger creature could emerge, not a weaker one. The study notes this and concludes companies like Oxitec should always conduct genetic monitoring when doing this work.
They should have in place a program to follow up what's happening after the releases have been started.
Oxitec says it does a good job monitoring the mosquitoes. These questions aren't going away, though. Earlier this year, transgenic mosquitoes were released in Africa for the first time in Burkina Faso. And last week, Oxitec submitted an application to release transgenic mosquitoes in Florida. For the World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Forget air conditioning. There's nothing like opening a window on a warm summer day, feeling the breeze, and listening to the birds chirp. Well, that's an enjoyment that could disappear. At least our grandkids won't get to enjoy it, thanks in large part to us. A new study published in the journal Science says North America has lost 29% of its bird population since 1970. That's a loss of around 3 billion birds. Billion with a B. Peter Mara is one of the study's authors. He says the loss hits all sorts of species.
Red-winged blackbirds, warblers, thrushes, eastern meadowlarks, a whole suite of species across diverse families.
The culprit? I think you know where this is going.
One only needs to fly, you know, up in an airplane and look down at the landscape and see that humans have completely manipulated the landscape, whether it's around urban areas and housing, or it's the amount of land that we've converted to agriculture, both in the U.S., Canada, Central America, South America. We are changing the face of the earth.
Birds control pests. They pollinate plants. They dispose of natural waste. In short, we need them. But before you get too depressed, there is a glimmer of hope, says Mara.
The good news is that nature is resilient once given a chance. So if we as humans act on this, if we start to really value nature, these birds will respond. They'll respond rapidly. In 5 or 10 years, we could easily see some of these species starting to increase.
So how do we act? Well, the study's website, 3billionbirds.org, lists simple steps we can take. You can plant native flowers in your yard, avoid pesticides, reduce your use of single-use plastics. Oh, and please keep your cat indoors. If we can do all those things, we may be hearing more of this. Perhaps you've seen the movie The Martian, you know, where Matt Damon gets stranded on Mars.
Right. Let's do the math. I got to figure out a way to grow 3 years worth of food here on a planet where nothing grows.
Well, now an international team of astronauts is living that, sort of. For 6 days, they'll be on a fake planet, a simulation in a cave in Slovenia. Guy Delaunay has been covering this story. He says one of the key skills the astronauts will be developing is searching for water in a foreign environment.
The idea of looking for water is sort of the holy grail, really, when it comes to exploration of Mars, and the idea that if there's water, there can be life. And a cave environment is, of course, all about finding where the water might be in a way, because the caves have been formed by water in the first place. So one of the things that you can do is try to find where the water is. And they'll also be looking for new species, which I think is rather nice if you're an astronaut. You don't often get told to go out and search for new life forms, but you can do that in a cave because the cave systems under Slovenia are extensive. And they're not extensively explored. So there is quite possibly a chance that they could find new species which have never been seen by humans before.
But unlike being on a planet, I mean, they'll have oxygen and other things that they wouldn't have way up there.
Very true. But the European Space Agency, who's running the exercise, says that a cave can recreate most of the stress elements and specific characteristics encountered in long-duration spaceflight. So in this way, we're talking about an unknown environment. So it's unknown to the astronauts, even if it's known to some of the cave specialists. Sensory deprivation. Well, it's dark down there. You don't know what time of day it is. Sleep disturbance, which follows on from that. And the social aspect. How does everybody get on in this team, especially when it's a team of people that have been drawn together from different space agencies? There are two NASA astronauts there, but there's also astronauts from Canada, from Russia, from Japan, and the most experienced European astronaut as well, who's from Germany.
Why Slovenia?
Well, Slovenia has extremely extensive cave systems. And if you get away from the sort of touristy caves, it becomes quite unnerving very quickly. Of course, we're talking about complete darkness, and you can very quickly get a sense of what it's like to be a long way from the rest of the world. It sounds different in a cave. This is part of the sensory deprivation. And this is all the sort of elements which the space agencies are looking for. Can their astronauts stand up to that sort of atmosphere? Are they going to get along in a team? And Slovenia is a good place for testing all of that out.
When they're in the cave for these 6 days, are they able to communicate with, you know, control, or are they just by themselves?
Part of the idea is that they have limited communications, or at the very least communication delays, because if you imagine it, and, you know, we've seen the films, we know that, for example, radio communications can only travel at the speed of light. Well, the further away you are from Earth, the longer it's going to take for your messages to get back, and the longer it's going to take for a message from Earth to get to you. So the part of it is trying to cope with these delays in communication.
Do they have to wear this big spacesuits and stuff while they're in there?
They're in caving equipment, so it's not really quite as bad. You would wonder, wouldn't you, how would you get around narrow caverns dressed in an EVA suit, for example? I think that would be asking a bit too much. But you can simulate plenty of things about the environment of long duration space travel, having a camp in space. This is all the things that they want to get used to over the next few years before we go back into the era of manned missions to other worlds. So hopefully going to the moon in 2024, says NASA. And the idea is to establish a moon base, practice some techniques on the moon, and then try and take the best practice from that to Mars. So this is all part of a chain of events which will eventually, hopefully, end up with human beings on Mars.
Guy Delaunay is the Balkans correspondent for BBC News. Thanks a lot, Guy.
It's a pleasure.
And we close our show right back where we started. The kids are trying to save the planet. School students across the globe have walked out of class today and are demanding action on climate change. The World's Carolyn Beeler is in New York with some students. Carolyn will be there for a few days to report on events happening at the UN. There's a climate conference among world leaders next week. Young people also have their meeting. Carolyn, what's in store tomorrow at the UN Youth Climate Summit?
Carol, that's a summit called by the Secretary General. It's going to be happening at the UN here in New York. And it was called not just as a way for youth activists like the ones that are marching right here today to make their voices heard about climate change, but also to offer real solutions, provide their own ideas, you know, for how to transition the world off of fossil fuels and provide funding for the communities that need it most to adapt, things like that. When I spoke to the special envoy for this UN summit, he told me that it's not just about involving youth or making them feel like they have a place to participate. It's really about asking them for concrete ideas because they're the future leaders on this issue.
And these are kids from all over the world?
They are youth through, I think, late 20s, actually, but also many younger teens. The United Nations has actually offered 100, they're calling them green tickets, to allow folks from all over the world to come to the UN, whether they might be able to come on their own dime or not. And those green tickets are providing the least carbon impactful mode of transit for those participants to come. So I think it's a play off that whole golden ticket from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Yeah. And then on Monday, I know the UN Climate Summit, the main event, that's happening then. What are you looking for there?
So I'm looking to see how many countries make new carbon-cutting pledges, like the Secretary General Antonio Guterres has asked them to do. Which countries those are? Are they any of the big major emitters like China or India? And how ambitious those pledges are. So are they aiming for carbon neutrality by 2050 and cutting up emissions in half by 2030, as the science suggests that we need to do? The Secretary General has asked for really concrete plans to be presented at this summit and not just speeches. And that's giving some activists hope that there might be some concrete actions coming out of this summit. Activists, including an Indonesian indigenous leader that I spoke with earlier today at a sign-making event. Her name is Mina Setra.
Every year, thousands of people flying to different countries for the UN Climate Summit, but it's always end up in papers. We are tired of these papers. We want these papers to be reality. And this time, the UN Secretary General said, yeah, this time we need action, no more talks.
So I'll be covering that event on Monday, and I'll be back here to report on what we're hearing from leaders at the UN.
The world's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler, in New York. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome, Carol.
If you want to follow the events in the streets of New York, check out our Instagram stories. We're at PRI The World. And that's it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.